Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 4th, 2006. Today's session is entitled Food and Development, World Hunger, presented by Norm Moline, number MON 2006-05. Let's listen in.
Pardon?
Yeah, I'll take
some. Sure. Well, I'm glad that you, as I said, I'm glad that you're here. We're talking about a topic. I didn't know how any way to put it, sort of a pizzazz spin on today's session in terms of a title. But it's incredibly important stuff. What's happening at the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines? I guess I should again preface this by saying again who I am, in case some of you haven't been here before. My name is Norm Moline, and I'm professor of geography at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois. Mostly interested in on the human side of the discipline rather than a soils and rocks kind of person, although I enjoy that, all of that stuff too. But on the human side of the discipline is a main interest, everything, which can include everything from geography of house types and geography of religion, geography of language and geography of cities, on to the geography of food production and population, environment issues, those kinds of things. And then I'm a specialist in Asia. That's in addition, I have two regions that I study, the United States and Asia. And I've been privileged to be able to go to Asia a lot. Augustana, I co-direct Augustana's East Asia Overseas term. We started these in 1974, and so every 3 years we go to Asia for with 80 people for a whole fall term. And so I've gone with all of them, so I've been lucky to have been to Asia a lot of times. But in our early programs, in my early studies in geography, I was introduced to the work at the International Rice Research Institute in Los Baños, Philippines. Of course, we all know that people in Asia like rice and use rice, and so this becomes a key place. So actually in our first program when we went overseas, which was 1974, I went over to the Rice Research Institute in Los Baños, in not too far, about an hour away from Manila. And one of my former colleagues at Augustana, in part, I need to give him credit, his name was Russ Riedinger, and when he was teaching biology and ecology at Augustana, he was invited to come. He was a specialist in rodents. And so he was invited to come to Los Baños to head up the Rodent Research Center, which is right down the road from this. And his job was to find a way to kill some of the field rats, not urban rats, but field rats that were eating rice. And of course, the more they eat, the less it's available in the yield for people. And Russ, oh, it was interesting going, just as an aside, before we get into the serious stuff, his wife also, I'd known her, and so it was fun to be in their home. And we asked Russ about some of the different ways they were trying to introduce to capture these rats. And he said, well, some of the people in the Philippines, if they don't see the rats are dead, then they don't think it's working. One of their best techniques, of course, would have let the rats eat some little stuff, and then they'd go back to their hole, and then they'd die. But the Filipinos, they wanted to see the dead rat. So, okay, one of the things they did, they found a way, without using pesticides, to kill the rats, and then to let the people know that if you kill these rats, you can actually make sausage out of them. And, of course, we think rats, oh, urban areas eating all that junk. But if they're just eating grain, hey, this is grain-fed rat. And so he told us, this was on a given evening, and he said, honestly, Norm, they really, they're very good. You wouldn't be able to tell the difference between a pork sausage. Well, he didn't know that the next morning his wife was serving pancakes and pork sausage to us. And so to this day, I'm not positive whether I've ever had rat sausage. He assured me, no, but believe me, that pork sausage sitting next to the pancakes that morning, I wasn't sure what that was about. But we went to the Rice Research Institute, and the significance of the Rice Research Institute is evident when we see this quote. It really started, as we'll see in a sign in a few minutes in the slides, but it's the beginning of what many of you know, I think. If not, I'm glad I can introduce it. It's the so-called Green Revolution. Norman Borlaug, a person at Iowa State University, He and a few other scientists started the idea that the one thing we're going to have to do on the planet to improve the amount of food that's produced is we're going to have to increase the yield. We're not going to be able to expand the acreage. I'm going to look with that table and look at that table with you for just a minute. But interesting, this year, a person who knows that I'm interested in Norman Borlaug sent me this from Farm Week newspaper. I don't think I've ever seen it before, but the person who writes this is the director of the Center of Global Food Issues and a senior fellow for the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C. Norman Borlaug saved people and nature with the Green Revolution. And here are just a few words of this. Let me toss out an intriguing question. He's still alive. He's 91 now. Is Norman Borlaug the greatest living American? Borlaug has never received anywhere near the public applause he deserves for his contributions to saving both people and wildlife with the Green Revolution. So it's nice to note that the still vigorous 91-year-old Iowa plant breeder recently was awarded the U.S. National Science Medal. He was the one, and as I say, in 1960, who said we need to find out ways in which we can crossbreed varieties of rice to increase the yield. I'll show you examples of how he did that. Because if you now look at the data table, first at this dull kind of a page maybe, but I started putting this together in 1970. I've been teaching for 38 years, so I started to put this together in 1970, and I keep on updating it every year with the data. And if you'll focus your attention, even though we're going to talk about rice, but if you go to the total grains set of data, you will see that in 1960-61, we had 746 million hectares. A hectare, if you don't know, is the metric measure equivalent like to acres. It's 2.5 acres. 1 hectare equals 2.5 acres. It's the metric measure for area. And so all of these things are in hectares. So 746, and notice there was a little bit of an increase. We're looking at the total grains data under area harvested. Went up a little bit there during the decade of the 60s and
wasn't
up to 1946?
646?
Pardon?
So that's 646.
What did I say?
You said 746.
I'm sorry, 646. Okay. I'm sorry. And then it went up a little bit to 700. But then notice, it's been the area in the major grains of the world. And these are the key staples. Coarse grains is going to include everything like rye and barley and corn and almost everything else that you can think of other than wheat or rice. And so these are the key staples for people to eat around the world. And so you can see we've been on a slide for, and it actually would, well, since 1975. And Borlaug knew that this would be the case in 1960 because essentially virtually all of the cultivable arable lands on the planet were already in use. I mean, some of you heard me talk about China yesterday. When I first started to learn about China, they said 10 to 12% of China's land is arable and in use. 2006, 10 to 12% of China's land is arable and in use. They had no room to expand from 1960 to the present and most places around the world. So if one looks at the basic data, the basic way you calculate, our goal is food production. And you can take those two columns there, area times yield equals production. One of the simplest formulas you can possibly learn. So everybody in the room will know that. So if your area is not going to go up, and knowing that people, there are going to be more people, and that the existing people need to eat more food, the Green Revolution people said, there's only one item left in this formula we can change, and that's yield. And you can see, this is when the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, and monies from different parts of the world created, initially, two research centers to somehow deal with yields. And the one dealing with rice, and rice then as well as now, is the main staple food for about 50% of the people of the world, certainly in Asia, all from China, Japan and China, all the way down through Southeast Asia, over to India and Bangladesh, and then hop over and pick up some good grain production in the Nile Valley. not much in the New World, but in those places you're going to get about 50% of the world's people. That was IRI, the International Rice Research Institute. So I'm going to keep talking about IRI today, but that's the International Rice Research Institute, IRI, like this, and that's in Las Piñas, Philippines. The other place goes by, I won't attempt to sort of speak correctly in Spanish, but it's C-Y-M-M-Y-T, CIMMYT, which is in Mexico, and that's the Center for Wheat and Maize Research. Those were the two initial ones. Now, as it turns out, and I won't bore you with that, there are about 15 to 20 of these internationally sponsored research centers on how to improve the quality of food. So IRI and CIMMYT, Philippines and Mexico, were the two main ones. And again, for just a minute, if you look at the total grain figure, notice the yield, for put all of those together, I had to take all that data and do the recalculating. 1960-61, we were getting about 1.3 metric tons of grain per hectare. Let's assume for today as we go, let's assume this is a hectare of land. But now we're at 2.77. We're getting more than twice the amount of food out of this piece of land than we did before. So if it's area times yield, if our area hasn't gone up much, but our yield hasn't gone up, you'll see that our total production went from 846 million metric tons to 1,826 million. It's more than doubled, thanks to the yield. And as I wrote this paragraph below here, and this was up to February of 06, total grain production has increased 116% then since 60-61, while global population has increased by 110%. In 1960, the world had 3 billion people, and now we have about 6.3 billion. So we're just a little bit ahead. Food, if you're following this, food production has gone up 116% in 4.5 decades. World population has gone up 110%. So we're a little bit ahead of it. There's been some progress in food supplies per person. Unfortunately, food supplies still are distributed very unequally, leaving large numbers of people malnourished or undernourished. And that estimate, for those of you involved in World Hunger activities, I'm very involved with the ELCA, World Hunger Appeal, and the figure that's often used is about 800 million people in the world are without food. That's a figure that's been used quite a while. Which means as our population has gone up, we haven't been able to keep on feeding an increasing number of people, but it still means that there are a lot who still need the benefits of hunger programs. But thank goodness for the Green Revolution, or look at the problem, look where we would be. And that's the way I remember the very earliest stuff I read from Norman Borlaug. He didn't say the solution to world hunger problems is simply the Green Revolution. He said if we can look at yield, we're going to buy ourselves some time until somehow world population and food supplies will end up balancing. So he has bought the world 4.5 decades of time, and a lot of good things have happened about that. And so you can see the data. If you back up, we'll take a look at rice, and then I want to show you these slides, and then we'll talk about the new developments. Notice rice in 1960-61 was 120 million hectares, and now it's about 150. Notice again in rice, though, that area has stayed virtually the same since 1975. So with any of these numbers, they continued to increase area a little bit in the first 15 years I was looking at this stuff. But since 1975, for about 30 years, globally, the amount of land in rice production has stayed the same. Fortunately, once again, yields have gone from 1.95 due to the work at IRI and to some extent in China privately. China had their own kind of rice research. Now they're indeed part of the same network. But they were doing some work there even before they became full members. But it's mostly IRI, up to 4.00 metric tons, more than doubling. So thank goodness we've been able in the world, in the rice-eating part of the world, which proportionately probably has more malnourishment. Even we often hear a lot about Africa, but if you proportionately, the number of people that are in Bangladesh and Pakistan and India and Nepal that need the assistance, Asia may be the most troublesome area in terms of food. Thank goodness we've gone from 160 million metric tons to 402. I'm going to show you the slides, and then we'll talk about some of the So these are called HYVs, if any of you look at that, not HIVs. HYVs, high-yielding varieties. And some of you may have seen this. We were just there, again, about 6 weeks ago. I wanted to go back. And so my wife and I were there for a day and had a chance to meet with all of the folks. Here's the quote you've been, I'm sure, looking at. They have a variety of these statements on the wall in the exhibit area at Erie. So now, from now on, when you look at your Honda or your Toyota, you'll know what they mean. They even have their roots in this plant. Well, let's take a little jaunt down the roads. It's nice expressways in the Philippines, and they have this unique car form called a jeepney, only place in the world. They're on a former Jeep base back at the end of the war. That's how it got started. Jeeps that were left at the end of the war, they rigged these things up. Well, now they're manufacturing them like this, and they're just and you sit on them like a taxi. Well, this is rice country. Some of the soils here in the, let's see, in the Philippines are not too bad. Some places they are bad, but here, because this is volcanic material, it has a kind of a basic quality. You can see the outline of the former mountain. And here we have the transplanting of rice. These are the bundles. Maybe if you know anything about rice, you have the seed. You simply fill an area, maybe the size of this room, with just lots and lots and lots of seeds, and you let them grow so that they're about as high as this, which isn't very high. And then you have these bundles. And then those will be taken back to the people in the back. And here you see the transplanting going on. And maybe you've seen these in videos at school. This is a terrible task. There's a song, and I shouldn't sing it, but it goes something like, planting rice is never fun. Work from morn to the set of sun. Cannot stand and cannot sit. Cannot rest a little bit. Planting rice is no fun. Work from morn to the set of sun. Cannot stand and cannot sit. Cannot rest a little bit. This is a song, it's a Philippine folk song, and that's what they sing in the field. And I sing it here and say, isn't it kind of a nice song and a beautiful scenery? But they're doing that. These plants are being transplanted at about 8-inch intervals, 8 to 10-inch intervals. And imagine, this is hot sun, and you're down, you've got this bundle, and you're putting each of these in the ground, sloshing through each one of them, jamming them down into the ground. And you're singing, planting rice is no... It's a terrible job.
How deep is the water there before they hit the soil?
Oh, it can be at different amounts. They often flood it later. Sometimes, in this case, it's often just muddy. They'll add the water after. So they'll slosh down in it. That does lead to one of the diseases, schistosomiasis, where these organisms can get through wet feet. And so that's a problem. But they're on top of that. But this is done, in fact, in most parts of the world, now Japan and Taiwan and parts of China, but almost every other place, if you see in the National Geographic magazine, they show vast fields of rice. To this day, every one is planted individually, in contrast to our wheat fields and our corn fields, where we simply have mechanic ones. When you'll see some in a moment. So this is the landscape, the initial seed bed and the transplanting. This is the rice sensor. You look across a field like this. In the Philippines to this day, all of those are planted individually. They do intercropping, which means in the rows between the rice, or in the fields between the rice, this is taro. And the taro root makes a very good soup. They fix it delicious. China, you slice it up, it may be about the size of 2 or 3 inches across, and then it's got seemingly like, it's almost looks like Swiss cheese, but it's very, very good in soup. And here then, it's now time for harvest. Some of this is done in some countries mechanically, some by hand. So here we have some fields then that have been cleared. These are piles of the debris. This field is ready to be cut. At that point, they'll take the water out. So the water control in a rice area, they decide when they want to put it in, and they decide when they want to take it out. One other thing that's, I'm not showing that many slides today, but many places in the world have terracing. big difference between growing rice as opposed to the way it's done now, between rice and either corn or wheat, is that even if the landscape is almost sort of gently sloping, easily okay for farm or corn or soybean or wheat cultivation, if it's rice, you're going to redo that land so that it's almost flat. Not totally flat, almost flat. It has to have just enough of a bend so when you put the water in, the water will sit here most of the time, but a little bit of it is going to drip from here down to the next level, and then to the next level, and then to the next level. And of course, when you're getting ready for harvest, they shut off the water supply, and you walk through a wheat and a rice field when it's ready to be harvested, it'll be as dry as a cornfield or a wheat field, stubble. Stiff kind of bristles.
They cut it off kind of at the water level?
Right. Yeah, cut it down very low. The water will be gone by then,
yeah.
And they'll cut it just a few inches off the ground.
Okay, and then when do they flood it again, and then those roots and things, what happens to them?
You'll see it in a minute.
Okay.
Here we have it. So here's the way, see, this is maybe 6 inches, here we are, this is maybe 6 inches above the ground. Mm-hmm. This is as dry as can be, it's walking through like a hay field. This is the stuff that's going to have to be treated. Now they have a variety of kinds of threshers. They used to have to do it by simply beating it on the hand, by like a stone like this. You would take a certain number of strands of the rice and you would beat it on some this and that would knock the rice off it at the end. And you take toss that over here and then do that again. Now there are various kinds of portable threshers, some powered by your legs and some powered by machines. But anyway, this is the rice, and what they're doing now, they're shaking that so that the heavier rice will fall into the pile and the wind will blow the chaff away. So that's where, I mean, even the biblical image, separating the grain from the chaff, that's what they're doing here. They're letting the grain fall and then let the stuff you don't want, let that kind of blow away. Here they put this stuff out then to dry, sometimes right out on the roads. Buses may go right over it, it doesn't hurt it at all. Here's another view of this, you go right over this, and then they know when the rains are going to come in the afternoon, so then they'll put it aside and they'll put it out the next day, so they may harvest the grain for about a week. Then they'll bring it to a small little rice mill. Some of these mills are still very much small operations, that's why I'm glad I wanted to go back this year. It had been about 8 years since I'd been to rice went over to the Philippines, and I thought, gee, maybe my slides are all going to be outdated. Well, I took some new ones, and they still have these small little local rice milling places right down the road from the farmers. And then what they do often, this is kind of a waste, in some parts of the world they'll make different use of the stalks. Some will make paper, as in Japan, some will grind it up and use it as silage. Some places you just burn it off. In this case, they're burning off the stubble. And now this is the way it kind of looks as we see it here. And then you'll bring in either your water buffalo, pulling a kind of a disking machine, or like this one. Here you see this person is outside a rototiller, just like you can rent at a place. You see the person up here, rototilling. These have been done, these still have to be done, and that's what will happen, to answer your question, that's what will happen to the roots. They're going to be turned over, becoming part of the fertilization process. Oh, and back, let's see if this will go back. This is what I mean. Each of these right here, these are called buns, B-U-N-D-S. Notice this is just a little bit higher. This is just a little bit higher. That's not a very steep slope. If this were in Illinois or Iowa or the Dakotas or Montana, you'd easily plant your tractor up and down and you'd plant your corn and soybeans and rabbit without any worry. Here, even on it, you've got to turn that. So almost everywhere you see rice, it's slightly terraced. Not only the big giant mountain landscapes, but even in the lower places, somehow it's going to have the flatness to it. We're going to talk, that's one of the things they want to change. Then here's a nice road. This one is turning this, a more amount of greenery, a field that hadn't been used, turning that over to prepare the seed bed. Well, that's the nature of the rice production. And so in that mix, the Philippines, very much a rice-producing country. Here's where the UP Los Baños becomes a key place, the University of the Philippines, their agricultural university, wonderful place. If any of you, some younger ones here, if you want to go and study there and work with these places, they'll be happy to take interns and get people working on this stuff. And here's the symbol of the peasant with the water buffalo and the simple scythe for cutting the rice. And here's the famous place we get to, the Erie. It's established, as you see, in April 1960, with a lot of assistance coming from the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, and the Republic of the Philippines. Since then, many other nations, including the U.S., have become involved in this effort. This is the setting now when we look at it. You can see the mountains. Well, I mean, you know you are in an important place when you're at this spot. These different fertilizer test plots, seed test plots. It's a gorgeous day over there. Different seed varieties. It's manicured, of course, extremely well, because this is the stuff they're monitoring with every kind of piece of test equipment that you can have. Here we go back to the beginning, though. These were the two that became the famous ones. Okay, you can see that this one is taller. This one had better tasting rice, though. But the problem with this is a thin stalk, and so when the rice would grow and it would start to get heavy at the top, this stuff would bend over. So this still had a way to go in maturity, but this then would bend over, and finally, if it's real strong grain, or if you get any kind of rainstorm, which they get in the Philippines, pretty soon the very grain you want to harvest and eat is getting soggy. It's bent completely over into the water. This doesn't taste as good, but it has a stiffer stalk. Aha. So if we can combine the toughness of this stalk with the good taste of this one, then we're going to have the best thing. Like the beer commercial, tastes better, less filling. It's like this, tougher, but better tasting kind of thing. So if you put those two together, this is what they came up with. And IRE is the one that was the key breakthrough in the mid-60s. Didn't take long after the research got going that IR8 came up. And that's the one then that has, so it reduces, they call that lodging. When the tall piece of rice, when it bends over and it's wasted, and they call that lodging. So IR8 reduced the lodging, but still kept the good taste of the PETA version. So this was the first one. Well, then they continued. These slides were taken about 1980. So here you have IR8 and IR20 and IR26. Now they're way up so that they don't even use numbers anymore. Tall versus short, there you get the idea. Plus they also wanted to introduce they weren't really manipulating genes here, we're using crossbreeding practices, and they found that certain ones also yielded better in response to nitrogen. So that if you're going to use nitrogen as a fertilizer, don't put it on a plant which doesn't receive the nitrogen very well, put it on the plant that receives the nitrogen, and it turns out that the semi-poor varieties were better for this. Also then no herbicide or weeding. They did start to, one of the maybe issues with the Green Revolution initially was that if you now put in some weed control, notice you have a much fuller batch of rice here, whereas on this section, some of this is kind of green, but you get a lot of photosynthesis that's being wasted with the weeds. And so if we could get rid of this stuff in the rice field, the lost energy, let's get it over into that. So they started to introduce a little bit more of some kind of herbicide use. And you can see then the amount of weeds that began to take over. They also came up with types where the azolla, which you can see in this case, by having the azolla grown right with the rice, the azolla is nitrogen fixing. And so if that stuff is just floating around in the water like this, you may see some of this even in the US where you look at a body of water and it looks kind of greenish. Well, some of it may be a different kind, but in some places it may be azolla, which is really good because then that means as the sunlight hits it, the azolla actually is able to absorb into that system some of the air from the nitrogen from the air. And so rather than having to buy nitrogen fertilizers, you can let azolla do the work for you. Capsules, here's the untreated section. Notice it's kind of sparse. Notice the thickness of these rows compared to this by using various capsules that are introduced at the root of each plant for a little bit better insect control. The last of these earlier ones, they still have this. This is the rice seed bank. This is fully temperature controlled. In that building, they have the varieties of 110 to 115,000 different varieties of rice and more. Any variety of rice in the world is brought into that place. They have three different rooms. They have some rooms that are atmospheric temperature. They have some that are down about 70 degrees, 65 to 70 degrees, which in the Philippines is about 20 degrees less than what it is outside. And then they have some that are frozen. And that way they're keeping this seed bank. This would be one of those places which is quite, now all the more since 9/11 and other global terrorist activities, this place is being monitored a little more carefully. Nobody want to blow that up. But just in case, for 25 years, there's a duplicate set of all of these in the mountains west of Fort Collins, Colorado. Just down the air from us here. The full set, tucked back in the mountains, all of the seed varieties. So even if this place were destroyed, we still have the World Genetic Bank and rice stored back in our mountains. Well, I went back again this year, just as I say, about 6 weeks ago, new sign. The other one still exists at the other entrance, but Rice Science for a Better World. This map shows all of the different countries which have sent seed varieties to Las Banas, which would be right here. This doesn't distinguish the amount, but just that they've sent a variety. So notice here, a bunch of African nations where there's some rice that's grown, they've sent their varieties, even a few over here. In the New World, of course, the most common ones are right over here. As the next slide shows, here we see the different places, the different countries which are contributing to, right here, this is the Philippine flag, sending their materials that are there. They now have an even more sophisticated, they had this the last time, but it's all the more controlled, very sophisticated indoor laboratory where in each of those rooms they can control the amount of moisture. If they needed to get a little sprinkle each day at 2 o'clock, exactly 0.2 inches, they can turn on the machine and it's all programmed. Everything inside this is controlled to maybe mimic the seasons. And that way they can monitor exactly what this variety and that variety does. It's really food science at the top. This was a set that we saw, an experimental plot. One of the things they were trying to do was to develop a variety of rice which would be more tolerant of colder weather, so that it could be used in Korea. As you know, Korea is much further north, has a climate almost like ours in Illinois, where you get a distinct seasonality. Well, sometimes you may get a late frost or an early frost, and what can we do to maybe find a rice that would be tolerant enough of cold temperatures that even in Korea you might be able to get two crops a year in. 120 days to 5-10 days in between, 120, 120, 240, 10, it's 250 days. That means all if you can just get through about 115 days of cold weather, you might be able to get a double crop in even in Korea. That's what this was about. This experiment here, you see these were people doing the transplanting work in this Korean test plot. This one was put up even in the fields to this day. They still have problems with those field rats going in. And so this was the latest variety to build this kind of a fence, which then out of this polyurethane kind of stuff, which then dips underneath at the edge. And it's almost saying, okay, you rats, I dare you, see if you can get in this one. So they're trying different ways to, again, make sure that we're not losing grain to the animals that don't need it. This is one of the places where they were trying to do some good genetic work, where they were developing a very new variety, and they wanted to make sure in this plot, completely surrounded by water, they wanted to put it far enough away so that just in the case that there's a heavy wind day, and some of the pollen blows off of these plants over here, that it merely is going to fall in here and is not going to then cross-pollinate anything else around. And we'll talk more about this in just a minute. There are various pictures in the place. These are some of the rice leaves, liquid, which they're turning into. Here's those field rats that they're trying to get rid of. You see them there, some of them are going to go live over here in those buns, and there they are having a wonderful meal on the rice, and that's no good. Great for the rats, but no good for the rice. This was in the exhibit. And then they have a festival each year in which they use these lukbanins. This is using the rice in creating this special, almost like a paper, and this is what it looks like And in the hall at Erie, now they show how different cultures have created this art form out of rice. Well, what's happening now in this place? And that's what's sort of exciting and what we can use our last time. For now, they have not been able to come up with, if you look again at the data, if you look at the data, what's really happened on this curve, if we were to plot these two things out, if we take time and yield, there was that initial effort, and then we had some nice increases in yield, but beginning about 1985, the yield level has remained relatively flat. Meanwhile, population is increasing, so for a while we were making some good gains ahead of the population. This was a nice gain. Meanwhile, population is catching up. And now what we don't know, if current trends keep going with global population and increasing caloric intake per person, that curve would be going like that. That's the number we would like to reach for production. But if this yield curve keeps going like that, uh-oh, trouble for all of us. And some of the same trends have been visible with the wheat and the maize research. So they've been trying to find new ways. Can we find a new way to have this go up again? And when I was there 8 years ago, they said, aha, keep your eye open. We may have something to increase the yield. When we were there this time, they still haven't found that. They still haven't found this new magic thing to kick it up more. So what are they doing to focus their attention on some things? And if you turn now to the packet that I gave you, just going to tick off the things that are going. I'll let you read this essential food for the food part on your own. This is all, these are the direct materials that I got at Erie, with exception of one, which I put together on my own. The first one merely talks about how rice really is a critical food. We've said that. We don't have to dwell on that. Food security as economic stimulus, cited here, as in that initial article about Norman Borlaug that I mentioned to you. They have found that the places where they were able, the countries which were able to adopt the new seed varieties and the rice production goes up, that, here's another one, that as the rice production has gone up, it has had economic benefits through the rest of the economy. It has freed up people money and time to make money in urban industries and others. So if one charts out, and again, if we, and I've seen this in addition data, if you map out the countries, the curve of those that have adopted the high-yielding varieties, and then you compare that with a graph of overall economic development in the country, they're the same curve. Now, I'm not saying it's cause and effect, because there are a lot of factors involved, but certainly they are similar trends, and that's what the Erie people are trying to state here. But now what are the new initiatives? The third side, brown rice. One of the things they're trying to do is to, as we, those of you, I'm not maybe as good as some of the rest of you, but some in the room I think are probably pretty good about eating whole grain bread. Or in Minnesota, they like to talk about the brown rice, the wild rice of the north. Or others may talk about whole wheat rather than the milled wheat. Well, surprisingly, throughout much of Asia, the people prefer the white rice. And it loses a lot of value, as you can see in the paragraph down here, about four paragraphs down, where it says whole rice and whole wheat. They offer significant levels of protein and essential vitamins and minerals, but most of these are lost in milling. In rice, the polishing removes 15% of the protein, 85% of the fat, 90% of the calcium, 75% of the phosphorus, 80% of the thiamine, 70% of the riboflavin, 68% of the niacin. So Erie, through its member nations and its network, is now doing what it can to begin to get people to think they shouldn't be milling rice. Because now, obviously, we'll add all of these good nutrients, but as this handout points out, it will reduce the milling costs, and it will have a higher recovery rate because you're not bruising as much of the rice in the milling process. The big challenge is to overcome the preference for white rice. In some way, this, even though I follow rice, in some measure, I have to admit, this was a little bit new to me. I didn't realize white rice had lost as much. I know the stuff about wheat and that here, but I didn't know rice had lost that much. And yet for all these centuries, really, in which the East Asians have loved, East and South Asians have loved white rice, this is going to be a selling job to get them to think that you don't have to mill this. Find new ways to cook and prepare the whole rice. But if they could do that, that would be a way, without doing other crossbreeding, to maybe increase the beneficial amount of rice coming per plant. So they're working on it. As it says in here, one of the problems with this, the brown rice, as maybe with brown wheat, some of you may know this better than I, that has a shorter shelf life. And so the solution to this would be, down at the bottom, is to have just-in-time hauling. I think for those, if anybody here is in the business world, I think this is what's happening a lot of those places. If you need something, rather than keeping it on the shelf, just click your email or something and say, we'll have the part for you in a day or 2 days, rather than having a huge parts inventory. So in part, that's what they're saying they need to have. If this brown rice would have a short shelf life, we got to have a supply coming in almost all the time. Hello, we need some more bags of fresh brown rice, and it gets drilled. It gets sent, so that's going to take not only an effort changing the taste, but a different supply to meet demand network. But that's what they're working on. So the stuff at Erie aren't just the plant botanists now. It's some of this. The next page, the next innovation, and here, this is, again, I'm a geographer, not a plant scientist, but these two, the next two pages, the one on high iron and high zinc rice. They're thinking now that one of the real problems in the poor part of the world isn't just to get them a certain number of pounds or ounces of rice, but it's to make sure that their nutrition improves. And to talk about, well, in addition to the rice, you ought to have these vegetables, and you ought to have this, and you ought to have this, and now you'll have a more nutritious diet, and the kids and the old people will be healthier. Why don't we use the new information now with the genome stuff and do some genetic manipulation, not just crossbreeding, to be able to introduce into these varieties types of plant which will retain much more iron and zinc rice. So just follow along with me in the text here. Currently, polished rice contains an average of only 2 parts per million and 12 parts per million of zinc. Many Asian countries, rice provides 50-80% of the energy intake of the poor, but it does not provide enough essential micronutrients to eliminate hidden hunger, in particular iron deficiency, anemia, and zinc deficiency. So what's being done? Micronutrient, down in the next paragraph, micronutrient-dense rice is being developed. Micronutrient-dense rice. A number of iron storage protein and iron transport genes from other food, including some from our part of the world, some of the other grains, some from corn, some from beans, are being and genetically being introduced with into the gene system of the rice and are being evaluated in terms of what they may mean. Developing rice with high iron and zinc through the process of biofortification, it's the phrase they use, biofortification, aims to combine high mineral content with grain quality and agronomic characteristics such as the high yield and everything else we've talked about. And this is the main thing that's guided by the so-called Harvest Plus program. That's something that they're very excited about. They don't know it's going to be a little bit of a while till these seeds would actually become available, but it's in the next few years. They're getting some more test results. They think they'll get some good test results next year, and then they'll have to run some more tests, but perhaps by 2009 they will find they will have a new variety that then would be available for those parts of the world. What would the cost to farmers and consumers be down at the bottom? It's not anticipated that high iron and zinc rice seeds will be more costly for farmers to buy or to use to produce the crop. The price of biofortified rice for consumers should not be different. Again, this is not Monsanto or some private company saying this. This is this independent research saying once they have this down and they know how to do it, then they should be able to turn out those kinds of seeds as fast as the other varieties now are available. So they're very excited about this. And everybody I talked with there, even the people who are sort of concerned about what might this do to the whole system through the year, and is there any danger that if we do this, that then we could be opening up a can of worms, and they don't seem to be worried about that at all. If you turn the next page, the third one is the idea of golden rice. The golden rice, they're very excited about this. It's a U.S. scholar that's over there. The term golden rice refers to a genetically engineered yellow-orange rice grain that contains this beta carotene. The human body converts this into vitamin A. The most recently developed golden rice varieties reported in 2004 and 5 contain a gene from either maize or daffodil plants and a gene from a common soil bacterium. The enzyme products of these genes then lead to the formation of lycopene in the grain, a process completely absent from the polished rice grain, and then this is then converted into, eventually, the proto-vitamin A. How can this help improve human nutrition? Worldwide, 125 million children suffer from vitamin A deficiency. Many of them are in the rice-producing parts of the world, and in many of these countries, rice is the staple, and so they think if they can just get the golden rice out to these places, it's going to make the life of these little kids better. Golden, next cap of the next column, golden rice is expected to have a significant impact in reducing malnutrition and premature death. Mm-hmm. So you see, there's still a couple more to tell, but what was exciting to me, and that one of the reasons I wanted to go there, because I'd heard about some of this stuff, but to actually spend a day talking with one official after another and one researcher after the other, knowing that the HYV, the high-yielding variety curve, may not be going up. They're still working with that. But while they're working on that, rather than just continuing to sort of bump up against sort of no new progress there, the scientists, what are other things we can do with rice to improve the human food condition? And that, to me, is fascinating stuff. No company has, but this is good news at the bottom of this. They say, well, back up to the previous paragraph, varieties suitable for Asia could be released for more widespread growing within a few years of the field tests. Down at the bottom, no company has plans to commercialize a golden rice product in developed countries or developed countries. Successful developed varieties by the private sector will be donated for public use. They sound pretty confident here, but they admit to being a little worried about it. Because as they develop these varieties, private public funds are supporting Erie, but Monsanto and a big seed company in China and others, they're participating in this, and it's open stuff. I mean, this is open to the world, and they want it to be that way. Well, what happens if the group that ends up finally getting the new rice variety that really works, if it happens to be a Monsanto or the other, will all their wonderful cooperation and, oh yeah, we're good friends and don't have to worry about that, will that continue to be the case, if not worldwide, for particular countries? When it would, for example, if they find out a new variety and then the rice seed producers, even for the United States, for the Texas or Arkansas rice fields or for the California rice fields, if so, okay, now the people here want to buy some of these Erie and golden rice varieties in the U.S. and Monsanto is the one. Now is Monsanto now going to say private property rights? So now they'll establish a patent on it for use in the U.S. They're worried about that. Not real worried. But when I pushed them on that, how do you know that this happened? They said, we don't. But they're just keeping their fingers crossed. But they are not going to use the secretive approach ahead of time and say, well, since that's a problem, we're going to try and get patents on this and sort of set up some barriers. They want anything they find to be available to researchers in Russia, to the United States, or India, or Brazil, or in Egypt, you name the place, wherever there's rice that may go on, even in a small section of the place or where they're researching, they want this information to be readily available. So that's a nice model for them not wanting to sort of set up this little barrier. So that's golden rice, and they're excited about that. If you jump to a page later where it says system of rice intensification, this, I think, is another very interesting concept, and they're pushing this line of research heavily, too. The system of rice intensification, if you go down to the second paragraph, SRI, is still controversial in some circles, despite our ability, our meaning Erie, given more space than is available here, to explain in scientific terms why younger and fewer seedlings transplanted with wider spacing. Now, to you and I, you may say, well, that's easy to do. But if you're dealing with traditional societies, we've always planted it this way. We've always had seedlings that do this. To merely get them to go with younger seedlings, fewer of them, wider spacing, and notice the next one, no continuous flooding. As I mentioned to you earlier, that in terms of the need to have water, they're trying to develop a variety of rice which you would plant and treat just the way we treat corn and soybeans and wheat. It's a wet environment, plant it, assuming that most of the time you're going to get enough moisture to have the plant grow just like anything else. And if you happen to get a week or two where you don't get any extra water so the field is a little dry, no worries. That's what they're trying to develop, a plant that won't have to be in the wet, rice, flooded fields for 90 out of 120 days. They're pretty excited about that. And nourished by compost rather than chemical fertilizers that give a higher yield than conventionally grown rice. They know this now. They know this can be done. And it's a case now, you're almost calling your sociology and cultural geography people, the social scientist people, we got some good stuff here. Now, how are we going to get this village or this country or this section of the country to adopt this? That's the challenge for them. By changing how plants, soil, water, and nutrients are managed, a system of rice intensification can achieve average yields about double the present world average of 3.8 tons per hectare. When methods are applied well and so improve the soils, yields can reach 15 to 20 metric tons per hectare. Now, we just have the overall average here for rice at about 4. In Japan and Korea and Taiwan, they're already getting between 6 and 7. That's the highest in the world. The U.S. also gets pretty high in some of its intensively managed rice fields in California or in eastern Texas. Here, with this, we could get 15 to 20. That could be the way that sees that take off. Without even creating that much, in this case, we're not dealing with the genetically manipulated varieties like the golden rice. This is simply with some crossbreeding activities to be able to find something that, in fact, would grow like that. When it goes down to the bottom, the possibility of achieving higher yields with a 25 to 50% reduction of water management addresses a growing need to achieve to conserve water in this century. There are some of the varieties that would work for this where there is the genetic manipulation also that's going on. But they see this as, you go down the office in their building and you go down, it's a whole different research team on the system of rice intensification. So that's another track. And if you back up one, this is the last page, and it won't take long, we'll see what question you might have. On the page, I put this together, Erie's environmental agenda. They are very conscious about what the international community says and their own water use. They're really trying to develop varieties of rice which don't hurt the environment. Because what good does it do if you end up wrecking the environment? So you see this, and I pulled this together from a bunch of pages and condensed it for you to look at after the session is over. But poverty in the environment, third line down, research emphasis in the less favorable environments is to increase and stabilize productivity by improving crop performance under stress so that poor households are food secure. Trying to get varieties that if it normally would take 120 days with this much moisture and this much input, yeah, that's the ideal, but maybe it has to go 10 days longer and maybe we have 15% less water. And maybe we don't have access to the nitrates or the phosphates, and it'll still work good. So they're trying to develop varieties of plants which can be tolerant under a wider range of climate conditions, and that way even the poorest people who don't have money to have this and that, they're still going to get a good yield. They're working a lot on that, and that thing I've heard about for a long time. Farm chemicals and residues, trying to reduce this, the amount of manufactured chemicals, and finding ways to achieve some of those things with organic and other fertilizer stuff, the land use and degradation. They're trying to, second line, the key is to raise the productivity of rice in favorable environments. So then rice farming that's going on in bad environments can be ended. If we can grow more in this hectare here, then we don't have to use the rest of this stuff, which may be really hilly and prone to erosion and landslides and whatever else, like in the Philippines and Nepal. If we can just really get a lot out of this spot, then we won't have to mess up the environment. So that's what they're looking at there. Problem there, of course, a geographer would look at that. This is fine for the people who happen to own this. Now, how about the people over there? How are they going to get some of the income from the rice that's being grown here? And that opens up a whole range of social science issues. Water use and quality. More rice needs to be produced with less water. We know that. And so, as we've already indicated, biodiversity. Erie recognized the importance of regional variations in traditions and practices and the rights of nations to build on their own culture and biodiversity. Erie, that's why we got all these member nations, they make themselves available to the different cultures to work within their traditions. And they promote the conservation of biological diversity by encouraging rice culture diversity. So the stuff in Korea be different from the stuff in Taiwan. Stuff in Taiwan is different from Indonesia. They're worried about climate change, as everybody is, but they're trying to anticipate what happens if it goes up a degree or if certain parts of the world get a little less moisture, a little bit more. They're working on that, and they feel that as long as they keep this research up, that they should be able to deal with that, other than some of the flooding problems. And the last one I stress, on use of biotech, Erie recognizes the need and potential of modern biotech, particularly genetic engineering, to introduce novel genes into rice. Erie is working on developing and sharing transgenic products in rice-growing countries and assisting in science-based procedures and policies for the biosafety evaluation of the products. Again, if this were a private corporation, we might say, gee, this is nice corporate rhetoric, nice slick gloss material, but Erie is a pretty careful, conservative place because if they know just one mistake, a new one of their genetically modified varieties would get out and end up causing a problem, their credibility around the world would be just shot. And so stuff is not going to come out unless it is, we think and they think, unless it's okay. So as you see, it's kind of fascinating what they've done. Similar kinds of things are going on in Mexico and at the other places. It's exciting, I think, to celebrate this. It doesn't say it's all perfect. Some of the people have shared more in this than others, so how do you redistribute things? But now it's going much more toward a holistic way of looking at not only the rice seed, but how does it link with water use and length of season and the cultural preferences and all of that. And to me, that's a kind of nice maturing of this agency. You have some questions? A lot of info, but yes, please.
The newly developed rices, are they self-replicated? Are they sterile?
They have to buy the seeds. For the most part, they still have to buy the seeds. We did bring this up. At this point, the time may come. They would hope that they could develop a variety so that farmers, as they harvest the rice, if they could hang on some and then be able to use it. But at this point, as I understand it, again, sort of 70% sure that this is the right answer to that, is that people are going to have to buy the seed product each year rather than something which is simply going to...
Who's making the seed product?
Pardon?
Who's creating the seed product?
That's where they would work with the companies. They're working on it now, and then they work with some of the Philippine companies that are there, but once it would go, when it would get to the U.S., it would probably, or other companies would have to go through the big seed companies, right? That's always, it's been an issue. I'm not sure, you know, whether it was behind, but that's one of the things we've talked about. Once you're dependent upon seeds, then the people who have the money can buy the seeds and the poor can't, so you increase the gap between the rich and the poor. Now, some countries have been able to do much better on that in the sense that the government subsidized the cost of the seeds, and then they make that available to the villagers at a very low cost because then they know they're able to do it, and that's an approach that I think is a good thing. For it, I'm not saying about the U.S., I don't study the U.S. rice production at all, but in places like in Vietnam or in Thailand or elsewhere, if the cost of the new seeds is too much, doesn't take too much for the government to subsidize that additional cost, and then the farmers still have to pay their own and you get it out. But you, That is has been one of the problems of the Green Revolution. It has enhanced the gap between the rich and the poor in some of those agricultural areas. Other questions?
Is there a greater financial need to stimulate the research? You mentioned the Ford Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation. Do you think Gates will get involved in something like that?
Who knows? I'm glad you mentioned that, because the last thing I talked the last day when I left Erie, I said, what should we tell others about this in terms of what they can do other than just simply being educated about it? And the only thing he said was to do anything you can to urge can maintain the investment in publicly funded agricultural research, with the emphasis on publicly funded. Maintain investment in publicly funded ag research. They say that's the only way to really help the poor. And this publicly funded research is needed to balance what may be told from the private sector seed places. So I'm sure Erie is looking for funds. One of the depressing things is that our government, as well as some others in the last few years, have cut the funding going to Erie. And I said, it's not very much. I should have written down. The amount of money coming from the U.S. isn't very much. Somehow the figure pops into my mind, something like $40 million. Well, $40 million isn't much, but $40 million compared to the cost of, you know, planes and all kinds of other things in the U.S. is pretty small for one of the more important places in the world. But we're not the only one cutting back. Some of the other nations, not because Erie isn't doing the job, but they're sort of tightening their own belts, and they're not as interested in the international stuff, so the public funds are not coming in as much. So they were actually saying they're going to have to cut some staff. And I just walked away thinking, how can that be? The overall budget, I think the overall budget of the place is maybe $42 million. So the U.S. component is even less than that. In any case, that's the one thing that they really wished. And so they would hope if there would be some good foundations. My guess is that probably Gates would not get involved, because overall East Asia is doing so much, Southeast Asia are doing so much better than Africa, and he's committed to somehow get Africa on board. But they would welcome anybody else. Well, again, I'm glad you're here. The last thing I would say is, in addition to, I hope this informs you a little bit. Two closing thoughts. One, I've been working with the Church's Hunger Appeal for a long time, and linking up with what we said yesterday about China, one of the good things in the whole world food situation is that China's been able to feed itself. And I always remind my members of the Synod Hunger Committee, I've been doing this again since the early 1980s, in which I could say, thank goodness that China is doing whatever it is without going in the deep. They're doing the right thing internally so that their 1.3 billion people are not on the world food need lists at all. And they are a player now in this ag research effort, just like any of the other countries. And the other thing, despite everything that happens here, there's still going to be hungry people in the world, because of the unequal distribution. And some people say, well, we could have enough to feed the world if we would only have the better distribution. And I say that's an if which doesn't even belong on the table, because distribution is a very big issue, and it's not an issue, very hard to do. And so you can't say, well, it would be all right if we did that. That's like saying, you know, we'd have sunny weather here all year if we didn't have clouds. I mean, it's kind of like that. It's going to be impossible. So therefore, I urge you and your congregations, if you're in the Lutheran Church or Catholic Church, to continue to give generously to the hunger appeal efforts, because despite all of the good stuff that's going on here, there's still going to be pockets that really need our assistance with basic projects like we heard about a little bit yesterday. So again, thanks for your attention.